Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I'd like to welcome back my guest, great co-host, Dr. Bob Gwaither. Welcome back to Your Health, Dr. Gwaither.
Thanks, Adam. It's great being here.
You know, we've got a really interesting show today and a fascinating guest. We're talking with filmmaker and producer Crystal Emery about her award-winning new documentary, Black Women in Medicine, really talking about race and gender in the medical profession. This is something that we all encounter, but we really don't know enough about.
And she points out that the numbers of black women physicians is really way below the presence of African Americans in this population.
Yeah, so I really look forward to having that conversation. But first, we're actually going to talk about some interesting research that matters. And our very first research that matters is an article that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association subspecialty journal Dermatology about, does it matter how a prescription is written, electronically sent over to the pharmacy or printed out and given to the patient?
Oh, this study was done right here at UNC by somebody, I'm going to hope to say his name correctly, Adewole Adamson, who studied patients, large number of patients, 4,300 prescriptions written for almost 2,500 patients, and measured what's called primary non-adherence, meaning they never picked up their prescription. And the question is, were the electronically called prescriptions more likely or less likely to be picked up? And it turns out that the ones that got called in electronically were 16% more likely to get picked up.
So if I write a prescription and I give it to you, you're actually less likely to perhaps get it filled, because this is primary. They never got it filled, versus if I say, I'm sending a prescription to your pharmacy. Why do you think that is?
I'm totally guessing. Dr. Adamson's great to point out that there's not much research done this, and he's one of the first ones, particularly in dermatology. I don't know. Maybe it's the knowledge that something is waiting for you there and that your pharmacist already knows it. Maybe
because your pharmacist they keep calling you. So I think that there's a reminder in place.
And you can't lose it.
And you can't lose it. You're not embarrassed if you lose it, call your doctor.
Some of those written ones probably get lost, and that may be a part of it. I don't know. Nobody really knows.
Yeah, I think this is really interesting. And one way to say that how this could help and be relevant to our patients is to simply say, if your doctor is writing you a prescription, ask them, could they send it over electronically?
Right. And our doctors actually try to do that because it completes the loop.
There's another research that matters. That's about lung tissue. There's a tremendous need for transplant for lung tissue, given the fact that lung disease is one of the major killers worldwide of people.
And I know they're looking for a model to study it, and that's what they hope to get with this.
Yeah, this was a study that was published in eLife, an interesting name of a journal, by researchers at UM Medical School, University of Michigan. And what they're looking at is, could they take tissue, we believe it's human tissue, lung tissue that's not differentiated, perhaps stem cells, they haven't differentiated really, and put them in mice and cultivate these or even grow them before they go into mice, but to put lung tissues and try to develop artificial lungs.
And use those for various experiments with drugs or whatever to see if they can affect the progress of the disease.
They initially had shown that many lungs grown in a dish had, you know, that could kind of simulate some of the lung growth, but they really didn't develop into kind of the full-grown lungs. And yet when they were able to finally successfully get these miniature lungs into these mice, they came up with what they called a biodegradable scaffold. That sounds kind of interesting.
Yeah, and it sounds like some rigid structure that lasted long enough for the lungs to develop. Interestingly, they had two parts of the lungs they were trying to develop, the bronchi, which direct the air, and the alveoli, which absorb the gases. And the alveoli didn't do so well as in developing as the bronchi did.
But you can tell Bob and I are kind of fascinated by this. And we think coming to the show to hear about research that really may be evolving. We know there could be some controversy in terms of how some people feel about stem cells. And we're not really getting into that particular controversy, but know that there is ultimately something that's coming out there that may ultimately help people who really are dying and would die otherwise. Let's talk about our next research that matters, which is about the secret to a happy sex life. Research that was looking at how people respond in couples to challenges in their life, and do those do they see the challenges in their sex life as the main issue, or is there more likely to be challenges in the hard work that it takes to maintain a relationship, which is more important to improving the sexual satisfaction?
And what you found was that people with these, quote, sex expectations, that they needed to be amorously in love with somebody and have them be their true soulmate, didn't seem to be as strong as people who want to work on sex problems together and overcome them, and also not let that pervade the rest of the marriage or relationship.
It's like this hard work and effort. You don't expect that you can get sexual satisfaction without hard work and effort. This was actually almost 2,000 people. It was in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology. And I think this is just kind of common sense but important information, maybe removing some of the pressure that if the sexual satisfaction in the relationship isn't great, you really need to go and talk and work and make sure that the relationship itself can be strong, and that may actually improve the sex life.
Right.
That sounds good.
Get some help with it if you need it.
Yeah, let's talk about our last research that matter, Bob's. And this is about computer assessment of a patient's answer to certain questions about depression and to what extent that may be able to predict really at-risk people who may be thinking about suicide.
Yeah, and this was done and published in the journal Suicide and Life-Threatening Behavior. And you can just tell it's people who are looking at the impact of electronics on all our practice these days. And they wondered if they could devise a test, electronic test, that they could give to people and see if they were suicidal, mentally ill but not suicidal, or neither.
Yeah, they were answering certain questions that we might normally just fill out in a scale, like, do you have hope and to what extent? Are you angry? Does it hurt emotionally? And hearing the participants' answers, and they looked at both the verbal and the nonverbal language. I assume they videotaped these. And then they looked and classified them into three groups. And they really basically found that these machine kind of smart algorithms could tell the difference between these groups, I assume high risk, medium, and probably low risk, with a very high accuracy. What do you think? Is this something that has potential?
Well, it does. They were comparing the response on the electronic measuring device to actual interviews by somebody, and they got a 93% correlation, which is very high. This is Dr. John Pestian from Cincinnati's Children's Medical Center. He's a psychologist. And I think that they're on to something about this can be done by not just the physicians who could do it themselves, but also it can be done by other clinics, other places, and probably save some time.
Yeah, I think this also could be useful for when someone perhaps calls up a hotline or a screening that could be done to make some recommendations. The issue is, if you really are suicidal, you'd need to be talking with someone, probably not a machine at that point in time. And so the question would be, the next level of research might be, well, let's say that this machine algorithm classified someone as suicidal. What happens then?
Uh-huh. And what are you obliged to do from a sort of medical legal standpoint?
Yeah, really interesting. Well, that'll conclude the Research Matters portion of our show, Bob. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be talking with filmmaker and producer Crystal Emery about her new documentary, Black Women in Medicine, as well as race and gender in the medical profession. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Wyther. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Gwyther. Today on Conversations, Bob, we're talking with filmmaker and award-winning producer Crystal Emery about her new documentary, Black Women in Medicine, a discussion about race and gender in the medical profession. Welcome to Your Health, Crystal Emery.
Hi, Bob and Adam. Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, you are so welcome. We are so fortunate to have you on. And just as we get started, maybe you can just tell us a little bit about yourself. And how did you come to be interested in highlighting African-American women in the medical field? How did that happen?
Well, I believe it was divine intervention. I was very busy trying to get a job with Will Smith or sell one of my screenplays to Hollywood. And I was asked by Yale Medical School, some doctors working on the bicentennial, if I would accompany them to New York to interview the third black woman graduate of the medical school, Dr. Doris Weathers. And I went to New York, and upon meeting her, I was just amazed by her story. And so then I accompanied them to Washington, D.C., and I met Dr. Beatrix Hamburg. And when I met her, in the company of her husband and her daughter, Peggy Hamburg. At the time, Peggy was the director for the FDA. What really got my attention was the love between the two doctors. And I thought about what was it like to be Jewish, because Hamburg, her husband, is Jewish, and to be a black woman in 1948, graduating from Yale Medical School. And it was not a pretty time. Like now is not a pretty time, but... And I just thought, this couple has been together for, you know, 50 years. What is their story like? And so I just started talking to, interviewing some doctors, Dr. Velma Scantleberry, the first black woman organ transplant doctor. And it wasn't that I set out, you know, strategically to create the documentary Black Women in Medicine.
We are so fortunate to kind of be the byproduct of perhaps a path that you didn't even know where you were starting.
And I didn't know where I was going. Because actually, my goal was to address the issues in media around black women. And they're always so negative. And I wanted to, once I met these women, to create something that showed the positive and for little boys and girls. And I don't mean just brown boys and girls, because it really is the triumph of the human spirit. But what happened was the film took its own journey. And, you know, we just became Academy eligible. We were in California 2 weeks ago where Danny Glover hosted a screening where we invited Academy members. And so we're trying to get that Oscar nomination. And that's not where I started 5 years ago. I just started with these extraordinary women and wanting to share their story with a younger generation who feel so hopeless. And it just blossomed into a book, an educational tour, and this interview.
We see that your project here is really multimedia. It's the film and an educational tour and a photo book essay. Tell us about how this thing presents.
Well, the photo book came out of one day I was looking for PR stills, and I started looking at all the photos, and I was like, wow, these women are so gorgeous. And so I said, we'll make just a small book to accompany the film. But once I laid it out, I realized there was a bigger story there. So I went to 30 women, and then I added the ancestors, some of the pioneers, And then it was uneven because a lot of the doctors were on the East Coast. So I searched across country, and it wasn't about what your discipline was or your specialty. It was about what story you had to tell. And so we have everything from anesthesiologists to surgeons to primary care to psychiatrists to two surgeon generals. And it's amazing. It's amazing testimony to the power of determination. It's also nothing like it out in the world because it really is a tribute against all odds, Black women in medicine.
Tell us what problems and what are some of the unique problems that you discovered about Black women in medicine, the problems they face, and maybe give us an example or two from the people you spoke with.
Some of the unique problems. You know what they are. You guys, you see it every day. You know, there's sexism. I think Dr. Claudia Thomas points it out well when she talks about being at Johns Hopkins in a meeting and a doctor says, you know, Dr. Adams and Dr. Bob and you know, Dr. Jones, but every woman he refers to at their first name. So I think that some of the issues are unconscious biases. I think that we still live in a society that does not value Black people, and particularly Black women. And so these obstacles are very real. So it doesn't matter if you have the educational background. You still have to fight this ism vortex, sexism, racism. Look at the numbers. I mean, you know, 100% of doctors, 32% of that are women, but only 2% of that are Black women. And only 4.5% of all doctors are African American. You know, what does that say? And what does that say about a profession that is based on healing?
Since we got a problem, Mission Control.
Yeah, we have a problem.
What do you hope young girls who might be listening now or who watch your film will take away from it?
You know what? And let's not just make it young girls.
Okay.
Let's make it to anybody watching the film. First, with young women, they are bombarded with so much media. And media that, you know, is about sex and immediate gratification. My thing is to show you can think big, you can dream big, and you can make it happen. But then the film is also for, you know, Bob and Adam, your population, mainstream America, because you have to recognize, you know, maybe you don't know any Black women in your inner circle, and maybe you don't know what these women's contribution has been to the healing of America. What really got me with Dr. Doris Weathers is that her research on sickle cell prolonged the life expectancy from 18 years to over 50. You know, like somebody should have given her every award in the world. And yet she is present but unaccounted for.
Yeah, well, we're going to need to take a short break, Crystal. But I'd like to actually come back and I kind of explore what's stopping us from making the do and celebrating and promoting as role models for all of the medical profession and all of our young boys and girls throughout the country. But we're going to take a short break. And when we return, we'll continue talking with filmmaker and producer Crystal Emery about her new documentary, Black Women in Medicine. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Gwyther. We'll be right back.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health. You're listening to Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Gwaithers. We've been talking with filmmaker and producer Crystal Emery about our new documentary, Black Women in Medicine. And right before the break, Crystal, you were talking about these seminal figures. You've interviewed some of the leading women in the world, black women in the world, who've overcome so much and achieved so much. Give us an example of someone who stood out to you for illustrating things that you wanted the American public to know.
You know, I think every single person in the film is an example that stood out to me. I love every last one of those women. You know, you look at Dr. Claudia Thomas, the first black woman orthopedic surgeon. You look at the field of orthopedics, which I always think of as the carpentry profession.
Me too.
Even when women become orthopedic doctors, they usually do hands or feet, where Claudia was hips and knees. I look at Dr. Barbara Russell Lee, who grew up, you know, in inner city Detroit, was smart, went to college, got married, had two kids, quit school, who came back to become the first dean of a medical school. I look at Dr. Karen Morris Freezer, who had five kids, graduated from high school, did not even know what an MCAT was, wanted to go to college, and went to night school and entered Yale Medical School at the age 40. I mean, any one of those women's story is amazing. One of the things I was able to capture was Dr. Jennifer Ellis, cardiothoracic surgeon, doing open heart surgery. Now, there are only five practicing black women that are cardiothoracic surgeons.
Wow.
And the fact that I got a film crew into a hospital, you know, that just was amazing. So all of the women in the film story is just the American dream.
And you actually would think that because they had to overcome to do it, they must be some tough people to do that and accomplish what they've accomplished.
You know what? I think they are determined people. You know, I think that anyone that I know who is a good doctor, they're a little OCD, and they're real determined. And you have to be that because people are trusting their lives in your hands. But I think that with women doctors, you also get that nurturing quality where I find more women doctors look at the whole patient and not just the symptom or the disease.
I know you've had some health challenges in your life. Have you found a black doctor or an African-American doctor who has worked with you that has brought that home to you?
Well, you know what's so funny? It wasn't until I started doing this film did I realize that out of my 11 doctors, not one of them were black. So how about that? I didn't even think about it. Because I have great doctors. When I am seeing my doctor, as I had to see today, I'm not thinking about what the color of their skin is. I am thinking about, are you the best at what you do, and can you help keep me alive? So it was only when I started this project and started looking at the numbers. I mean, think about it. There are only two black women organ transplant surgeons. Why is that? And Bob and Adam, maybe you should tell me why is that.
Oh, I think we have discrimination in all sorts of ways, from the process of getting selected to the process of encouragement to pursue careers in science to college admissions. It's all the way down and through, and we need to be starting and supporting and encouraging and facilitating. That's my short answer. You know, I wonder though, you have experienced as a woman, as a black woman, and as someone with a disability, the hardships that you do write about. And I wonder to what extent your own experience helps you understand the experiences of those who you write about.
You know, that's funny. I have a disease called Charcot-Marie-Tooth, which is a deterioration of peripheral nerve. And I am considered a quadriplegic. I use the word considered because that's not how I define myself. I am really energy in motion. But let's bring it back to your world, the medical world. My health experiences had nothing to do with black women in medicine. Not at all. For me, what I was drawn to was these stories of courage and perseverance and understanding of a higher power and a higher calling. It is the triumph of the human spirit. Like I said before, the last thing I wanted to do was have to do another project with the medical professor. Because, you know, you guys can be very difficult.
That
was an intervention. You know, I was given this task, and I am so honored and grateful to be able to tell this story. But it really had nothing to do with my physical limitations.
Well, as you've toured the country sharing these stories, what's been the response? Are there any stories you'd like to share with us about its impact on viewers?
I will share this story. And also, your listeners can follow us. If you go to our website, changingthefaceofmedicine.org, it's all one word, changingthefaceofmedicine.org. And you can see where the project, whether it's the film or a book signing, or the educational tour will be in your city. One of my favorite stories is this, and we won't mention the location. We were doing a screening and a book signing, and there are some little babies. I call them my babies, between the ages of 6 and 12, that I dressed up and took photos of them, so they're in the book as our future doctors. And one of them, their parent drove to come to that book signing. And she looked like she was crying, and I went over there, and I said, "What's the matter?" And she said, "Do you realize that all of my her daughter was 10, I only cared about if she graduated from high school and got a job with good health insurance." She said, "Today she is in a medical school signing books at a place that I used to clean the floors."
Wow.
"And that all of these doctors walking by never even acknowledged me. And yet they're going to get their book signed by my daughter." And she said, "I never thought it was safe enough for my daughter to dream this big." And so you have an impact on the parent, on the child. Now, let's go the other side. At that same book signing, a woman that they call the Dragon Lady, who is an admission officer, and one of the doctors told me this story. The next day, the doctor told me, she said, "You know, so-and-so came over, and she didn't ask me to sign her book, but she started talking to the little girl next to me. And at the end of the conversation, she asked the little girl to sign her book, and she told her, because the little girl wanted to be a dentist, 'If you ever want to come to medical school, here is my card. Call me up.'" Well, this is the same woman who is known in that admissions office to be very difficult to minority applicants. And so the impact, you cannot measure quantitatively or qualitatively, because when you are working on somebody's belief system, you know, change happens gradually. But that is one of my favorite stories.
You know, we're going to need to wrap up, but as I'm thinking about your question to Bob and I about what would we do, I think I have a different answer now, and I think that is that I would get your documentary in the hands of the American public and the American medical profession, because I think that might do more than a lot of the stuff that we've been doing, but maybe they can do them together. But if you could leave our listeners with one final piece of advice or thought about what we've discussed, what would it be?
That love and fear and this is not my quote, it's from my spiritual teacher, Guru Madeleine, that love and fear cannot reside in the same place. And that the paradigm, whether it's medical school or law school or just day-to-day living, has to change. This is part of the American dream. It's part of the American quilt. And it is the triumph of the human spirit. And so celebrate love. You know, nurture our young people so that they could be the very best that they want to be. And follow us. Follow us around the country. Again, you can go to our website, changingthefaceofmedicine.org, and there'll be a place where you could check whether it's a screening or on American Public Television.
Well, thank you so much, and we will certainly put that link everywhere.
And
thank you, Bob.
Very,
Adam,
very good luck with the Oscars. I hope to see you nominated this year.
Thank you. Namaskar.
We've been talking with filmmaker and producer Crystal Emery about her new documentary, Black Women in Medicine, as well as race and gender issues in the medical profession. And coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering your questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Weiser.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. On 97.9 FM, WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Bob and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about our listeners' health questions and concerns. And Bob, if they have a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send their comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we've got some really interesting questions today about colic, about ventricular tachycardia, and even diabetes. We're spanning the spectrum. We'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question.
My granddaughter is colicky, and I can tell it's driving my daughter a little crazy. Is there anything I can do to help? What advice do you have for the parents of colicky infants?
Well, I'm a survivor of colicky children.
You're a covering survivor.
Especially
of
my oldest, who had problems with colic until she was 11 months old, and then she vomited a lot too. So what we found by accident was that if she was in a car seat driving in the car, she didn't have the problem. And so we did drive around the block in order to make it go away a few times. And then we decided, we heard our friends saying, well, we put our kid on our dryer when it's moving, and it seems like the hum of that makes a difference. Well, we got pretty sophisticated, and we've had two grandkids with it now. And what we get is one of these A-frame swings and put the baby in there. Be sure you got it all, the nest created with blankets, and nothing's going to get stuck. But it just seems to make whatever the problem is a lot better, and the baby stops crying and everybody just settles down and life is happier.
Yeah, I do think that a lot of times reassurance is really important. I mean, this is a difficult. I had three children, and I do know one of them certainly appeared to me to have colic. And talking with your doctor, your primary care doctor, about this, because it may not be colic. There could be some other things here. But I do think reassurance is one of the main things. Would you ever be concerned? What make you concerned about something else, Bob?
Anything? Well, fever, diarrhea, other kind of symptoms that would go with it. But it's pretty – for us, it was pretty predictable. Every afternoon about 4 o'clock, she'd go for about 2 or 3 hours. And I do think that you should get it checked out. But once you come up with a diagnosis of colic, I'm not for giving drugs right off. And there are people who do that, phenobarbital notably. We wound up doing that until we discover the swings, and I think that's a better deal.
I have read, and I don't know your thoughts about this, Bob, that in some of the systematic reviews and clinical trials that for – particularly for breastfed infants, if they do have colics, that a probiotic, lactobacillus, reduce colic symptoms. And that seems like that could be something to do if indeed that you needed to be treated.
Sure, and I don't think there's any harm in doing that. There is one thing about the end of the rainbow that's okay here, which is that colicky kids seem to be brighter when they wind up growing up. So take a little reassurance in that maybe.
Well, that'll be at least the start of that. We'll put a bookmark in that. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I'm a 29-year-old woman who often has episodes of ventricular tachycardia. I'm working with my doctor to manage it, but I was wondering if you have any tips for ways to stop an episode once it starts.
Well, ventricular tachycardia can be a very serious thing if it gets out of hand. And so I don't want to make light of this, but you say you're working with your doctor. My personal style would have been to get a cardiologist involved with it, too. But there are ways that you can slow the heart down with some massage, particularly of big arteries. So you could see if you lie down on your bed. You don't want to do this standing up because if it dropped your blood pressure too fast or drop your heart rate too fast, you could faint and hurt yourself. But you can find your carotid pulse in your neck and rub it and put a little pressure on it, and that may make it go away. Or there's something we call a Valsalva maneuver in medicine, which means you're just increasing your abdominal pain, sort of say, an abdominal pressure, sort of like you would if you were trying to have a difficult bowel movement. And that also puts pressure on the aorta somewhat and can slow the heart down or get a so-called Valsalva maneuver.
Yeah, and a lot of times people think it's ventricular tachycardia, but it may be some other thing, another type of arrhythmia, an abnormal rhythm coming from the ventricle. I think, Bob, I would agree with you fully. If it really is ventricular tachycardia, you need to be working with a doctor, a cardiologist here. You may well need an implantable cardiac defibrillator. You may need medications like calcium channel blockers or amiodarone, which are these kind of anti-arrhythmics to control and prevent recurrence. This can be life-threatening. This is how sudden death can occur. So this is not something that you would want to treat on your own. You may need that 24-hour monitor where you can really see the rhythm to really see how frequently you're having the symptoms and then what happens to the symptoms. Do they get less?
Yeah, and I want to reiterate, I think as your doctor needs to know that you've got this and that it's not working, you're still having episodes, and perhaps request a consultation if he doesn't have any good tricks up his sleeve.
And a medical bracelet wouldn't be a bad idea to let others know in case you have it, if they come across it. We would definitely. Laura, what's our very last house call?
Type 2 diabetes was a problem for my paternal grandmother and now my father. As a 34-year-old man, what should I be doing now to prevent from developing it?
Well, first off, asking a good question, and you're well on your way there. Because you're asking at an age in which you may be able to make some interventions. And certainly you have a strong family history, and that may be difficult. But you know, I'd want to know, are your father and grandfather overweight? You know, that may have a genetic tendency, but that genetic tendency may only come out under certain circumstances. So if you are overweight, I would definitely encourage you to lose weight.
I agree with that. And I think health habits in general, get yourself in good physical condition, limit the quantity of simple carbohydrates that you eat, stay in the best shape you possibly can, may prevent this from occurring in you, although there's no guarantee on that.
One of the things you could ask about is, you know, medications. There are some medications. Side effect is raising your blood sugar. So whenever you're giving a medication by your doctor, you could ask to make sure that that doesn't do that. So you could be treating a medicine for high blood pressure, common medicine called hydrochlorothiazide, and it may raise your blood sugar a little bit. You may choose to take a different medication. And then we talked about this, I believe, several months ago. Smoking is now a causal factor in diabetes. And so if you smoke or around secondhand smoke, you definitely want to avoid that. So again, these are things you can do. Well, that'll conclude our house calls for our show today. And we hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to you and your health. You can share your questions by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Follow us online through Twitter, Facebook, online radio at yourhealthradio.org, or just look for our health app. Search Your Health, one word, for a free download. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for the sponsorship, and our guest today, Crystal Emery. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Bob Gwyther. We'll look forward to seeing you again next week.
Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.